Welcome to Writers on Craft. I'm your host, Suzanne LeGrand, and today my guest is award-winning poet and translator Jane Hirschfield. Could you talk a little bit about your creative process? How do you write a poem?
Poems for me are an odd collaboration of conscious and unconscious minds. I don't know what I'm going to write before I begin writing. I do have an almost kinesthetic feeling that says, right now, you need paper and you need pen. Sometimes I have a phrase that begins. Sometimes I have an idea, but I never know what the destination is. For me, the writing of a poem is always an act of experiment and of discovery, not of transcription.
And how then do you know when a poem is done?
Well, the first draft done is different from the really done. So I think I know I have a poem when I have found something I didn't know before. And I feel that sense of transformation or new comprehension. In some way, I have been changed. And I have been changed in a way which feels more grounded, more open, more alive, more awake, as if a larger world had opened for me. Once I have that, then there's a poem, and then I move into revision, usually rather immediately, although also time is the best editor, so I find it's really good to walk away from a poem, first for 5 minutes, and then like a new love, you go racing back to it. But then for an hour or 5 hours or a day or 5 days. And I know a poem is really done when it stops changing.
Do you rely on feedback from other people or do you involve other people in the process of writing at any point?
I am extremely unusual amongst all the poets I know in that very often a poem of mine will be published that nobody has seen except me and the editor who accepted it. I don't have a peer group. I don't have people I regularly exchange poems with. If I find myself stumped, if I'm having a real problem that I know I could use some help with, I have a couple of friends on opposite ends of the writing spectrum who I know I can send something to and say, what do you think, and get very good responses. But because they are from different ends of, the poetry world, their responses might or might not be the same at all. But one or the other will probably help me. But I do this really rarely. One thing I found was I needed to make my own mistakes. And I needed to be peculiar in my own way. It is a sign not of my courage, but of my timidity that I don't bring my poems to other people. You would be tempted to listen to them. And I know my first job as a poet is to write my own poems. Everybody else I know, practically, does show their work to other people. And I'm not going to say anybody should do it my way. I'm just saying this is the way I have to do it. I have to take absolute, complete responsibility for my own work.
And it seems like over time you have developed a process to understand and to know when you need to walk away and when it's done.
Yes. And I can talk a little bit about something which is probably relevant to this, which is when I revise, there are two ways of revising. One is revising from the inside and one is revising from the outside. And I try to alternate those ways of being with my poem. So when I'm revising from the inside, I am the person who wrote the poem in the first place, who needed to write the poem, and I am subliminally asking it a set of questions. Have you said what you needed to say? Did you hold back? Is it fully there? Is the music fully there? Is the passion fully there? So to return to that original urgent question and be sure that I explored it completely. Revising from the outside, I don't think anybody can do completely, but what I'm trying to do is see what is on the page as if I had no idea what it meant or who wrote it. What is it saying? Only those words. If you didn't know the situation behind it, do the words have enough to help the reader who isn't me enter that situation? And so I think because I teach so much and because I edit so many other people's poems, this is how I learned to edit my own. I think everything about a poem on a page is a set of musical notation. It's the score. It's telling you the pauses or the speeds or the tone or the intonations. I learned something wonderfully interesting the other day when Garrison Keillor read one of my poems on the Writer's Almanac. And, you know, it's not that frequently that a poet hears somebody else reading their work. And as I listened with great curiosity, what I found was he is saying it exactly as I do. And I was so grateful for that because what it meant was he was understanding my line breaks and the relationship of the line breaks to time. And as he read that poem, virtually exactly as I do, I thought, oh, that worked. You know, the score on the page worked. It communicated exactly how I hear it, enough so that he, never having heard me read it, could read it exactly as I had heard it myself when I was writing it.
What elements of poetry do you think can be taught? Or what elements of craft can be taught?
Yes, so wonderful question, because, you know, there's always the great skepticism. When I was in Poland in May, I went to dinner at the house of somebody who was not literary. My translator took me, and he scowled at me with fabulous Polish intensity, and he said, "Poetry can't be taught, can it?" And, you know, many people believe that, and in some sense that's true, and in some sense it's not true at all. Nobody makes poetry up from scratch, just as nobody makes music up from scratch. We enter a cultural field which has been cultivated for thousands of years, and we learn what a poem is from the moment we hear the first lullaby sung to us in the cradle. And so poetry is always transmitted. And the craft things which are transmitted, the one fundamental thing is attention, is awareness. And everything else is a kind of ladder into awareness. So when you learn the names of things, when you learn what an iamb or a trochee is, when you learn what a sonnet or a villanelle is, you are simply creating a handle for attention. You are honing your ear. So when I taught in Bennington, one of the things I said, you know, nobody was going to get through my semester with a passing grade if they couldn't scan a poem. It could be a rhymed poem, it could be a free verse poem, but I want to know that your ear is capable of following the stresses and the consonants and the assonance and the whole prosodic music of that. So that's one very simple thing. I think it's helpful to know the word image. It's helpful to know metaphor and simile. It's helpful, although not necessary, to know synecdoche and metonymy. We do these things. It's like the character in Molière who says, "You mean I've been speaking prose my whole life and I didn't know it?" These are the levers and engines and servo. I just learned about servos from a friend yesterday. You know, these are how meaning is made. It's made by rhetoric. I teach rhetoric. It's very old-fashioned, but I think there's a real difference between a poem in the first person and a poem in the second person and a poem in the future and a poem in the past tense. And these are tools a poet can have. And if you're aware of them as tools, then you know when you go to revise your poem, maybe you see, oh, I wrote that poem in the second person. Was that because that's the most effective voice, or was it because I was embarrassed to say I? It was the second person. There's about 9 different meanings to the word you in a poem. And it's really useful to know which one you're doing. Our current poet laureate, Phil Levine, is a master of changing who the you in his poem from the general you, which means anyone, to often the you that means you, the reader. And you can only do this if you're really clear enough in yourself that the person reading the poem doesn't get confused and doesn't go, which you is that, huh? Happens all the time. Never get lost in a Phil Levine poem. You just don't, because he is conducting it so skillfully. And you know, everybody talks about Phil Levine's subject matter. Nobody talks about his craft. His craft is amazing.
How long do you think it took you to learn craft?
I'm still learning. I think this is ongoing and infinite and never, ever ends. When you see a new poem that absolutely undoes you, the first thing you do is you just surrender. You're completely undone. It happens without any conscious looking at. But maybe 6 months later, you might take that poem and you might look at it and you might say, how did they do that? And you'll learn something about craft every time.
For those of you just joining us, I'm talking with poet Jane Hirschfield today on Writers on Craft. You've recently published your 7th collection of poems.
Yes.
Would you talk a little bit about the title of your book?
So there is a title poem, Come Thief, which is basically an invitation. It's saying, you know, every path will let down at whatever comes. Every window will let through it whatever is to be seen outside. The thief of this book is very much time and its passage and what it brings us and what it takes from us. But I also have an association to this, which is not anywhere in the book, but is strongly in me, which is the old Chinese story of the hermit monk who's living in a little hut and comes home from his walk in the moonlight and discovers that his hut has been robbed of everything except a frying pan. And what does he do? He looks around, grabs the frying pan, and runs out down the road shouting, "Wait, wait, you forgot this!" And I think that's the only relationship we can have to time. Please take everything. The last line in that poem is, you know, saying to time to the end, dear one, enter.
I know that you have practiced Zen Buddhism for quite a long time. Has that practice informed the practice of poetry for you?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, as a young person, I was looking for ways to know the world and know my own life more intimately. Poetry came first, but poetry led me to Zen. When I was in college, I read the poets of Japan, the poets of China, and there's a great deal of Buddhism underlying the worldview of those poems. And I became curious, and so when I graduated, the first thing I did was work on a farm for a year. And then it being the 70s, I drove cross country in a red van with tie-dyed curtains and wall-to-wall remnant carpeting that my boyfriend and I had put in. The boyfriend, alas, went off to South America. And I went and I looked at, it was summer and I could, the only Zen monastery in America at that time was Tassajara Zen Mountain Center in the Ventana Wilderness in California.
Also known for its bread, I believe.
Yes. Well, that was how I knew it existed. A friend of mine had the bread book, which told me that there was a monastery. And I thought I was just going to investigate this Zen business for a week or a few months. And I ended up staying in full-time practice for 8 years and have continued, you know, 30-odd years later. I'm still very much a practitioner of Zen, although I don't want that to be the identity of my work. One of the paths of Zen is to be invisible. And I think, You know, to go back to your original question, both Zen and poetry are simply practices of awareness, of finding a technology to allow you to pay a deeper attention, less obstructed by ego. And so for me, it's left foot and right foot. Zen practice and poetry, they're both doing the same thing. They're both ways to enter my life, ways to investigate my life, ways to make sure I don't fall into complacency or laziness, which I am prone to. I think we all are. But if you have something in your life which is always asking the question, what else? Or what is this? Then you will have to address that question. And poems do that, and Zen does that.
What's the hardest thing about writing a poem?
The hardest thing for me about writing is when I'm not writing, which is frequent. The writing itself, no matter how difficult it might be, it is also a joyous falling into a task. I mean, you might be stomping around, you know, what is that word? What is that word? Or I can't finish it. And it just feels torturous, but it is a joyous torture. Not writing is, for me, frequent and painful because it means I'm less alive at that moment. I'm less inside my own life. I'm more asleep. And that's difficult. But I suppose within writing, what I find is the hardest, and fortunately it's kind of rare, is when I have the poem but I don't have the ending. That's very difficult because you know there's enough there that you can't set it down. You can't just say, oh, failure, I'll move on to the next one. But to find the ending is to find what is it you know is there but you don't know yet. And that can be very, very difficult if it doesn't come organically. Sometimes the title is hard. You know, again, all these things, it varies from poem to poem. You know, sometimes the ending is almost the first thing you know, and then you're making your way towards it at a gallop. Sometimes the title is the first thing you've written on the page. But if it's not there, it can be very, very hard to find.
And have you developed any strategies for approaching the not knowing and staying with it?
It is, for me, you know, hardly even deserves the word strategy. Just go back in and try again. I think of it, so I'm not much of an athlete, but when I was a child, they sent me to summer camp and I had to do the long jump. And one of the things about the long jump is they always give you three tries. And so that's my feeling. It's just run up and try again. Run up and try again. And there have been poems when I've done that for 3 months before I found the ending. Just keep running up and, you know, fall in the sand as many times as you have to. Just do it again. Do it again. Put yourself in the position where you're doing it again. And that's all from the inside. Because to find the ending, or to find even the next line of a poem, is the hardest and most essential work of it, because you're looking, as I say, for what don't I know, but I know it's there. Sometimes the world will give it to you. You know, sometimes I have an old poem from long ago called Inspiration. And it's the story of a day when, because I was at an artist colony, I really wanted to write, because that's the one place I do write every day, is if I'm at an artist colony, I do not want to waste this opportunity. But I just didn't have an idea. And so I started looking in the books in the library. I took a walk. I sat down. I was casting. And the poem ended up being the story of looking for itself. It talks about consulting bird books, talks about taking the walk, talks about finally sitting down, and a fox walked by outside my window. And it really is the story of not having inspiration, and what do you do when you're hunting? You look around. You look in your back journals, if you're a person who keeps journals. You read somebody else's poem, looking to be awakened. You look at your own life. You think about that dream you had. Or you just take a walk. And when you're really open, when you're in the condition for writing poems, poems throw themselves under your feet. You know, that little hole that you walked by, you know, 10 times before suddenly becomes the source of the next.
Only you're now in the habit of noticing.
Right. It's all a changing of our own condition. And sometimes the world forces that on us, and sometimes we have to invite. And that's for me a question, not an order. I know there are many people who can actually decide to write a poem and sit down and write one. I can't. All I can do is ask, are you anybody home? Anything here? And keep asking until the tiniest thread appears, and then you touch that thread, that word, that question, and you follow it. And if you're lucky, there is a poem at the other end.
What do you know now about poetry that you didn't know when you first started?
When I began writing as a child, I believed at the time that it was expression. And what I know now is that it's investigation.
This has been Writers on Craft with Jane Hirschfield talking about writing and the creative process. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on and for having this program.
This has been Writers on Craft, a show about writing and the creative process, produced by KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. For program notes or to listen to a podcast of this show, go to kboo.fm online or visit our website at www.writersoncraft.com.